Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of April 23rd, 2010. We're coming to you this week from Seattle, where walking away from your home doesn't just happen with houses, but shiny new condo buildings, too.
About a quarter of the people who put money down walked away, leaving deposits of up to $100,000 because they saw the values dropping so fast it was cheaper for them to just walk away and leave their deposit.
One man's disaster is another's good fortune. Rents shrank and the attractions of apartment living grew.
We got a free 32-inch TV. We got like 7 months of free storage and some free 3 months of free parking. I mean, it was just, the list kept going and going. It was absolutely, it's amazing.
But first, we've been hearing for a long time now that the economy will not get better until the housing market turns around. Well, this week we learned that mortgage default notices in California dropped by 40% in the first quarter from the same time last year. And as California goes, so goes the nation, right? Perhaps. But you would also do well to take a long look at what's going on here in Seattle. And that's exactly what we're going to do this week as we broadcast from the Emerald City. Seattle's Volunteer Park sits atop one of the city's tallest hills, and we're here to get a sense of the area's housing geography. 2.5 years ago, Forbes magazine labeled this the most stable housing market in the country. And for some time after that, Seattle managed to stay as upright as its famous Space Needle, while other communities slid off a cliff. But the froth in home prices eventually matched the froth on the city's beloved lattes. And now, the market is in a decaffeinated decline. For a better view, we walked up a narrow flight of 106 steps to the top of the park's water tower, a perfect vantage point for a discussion with Stan Humphreys. He's the chief economist for the Seattle-based real estate website, Zillow.com. Hi, Stan.
Stan Humphreys.
Nice to meet you at
pleasure
the top of
you.
Seattle.
How do you do? It's a pleasure to be here.
Very well, thank you.
Brought some nice weather with you.
We certainly did, yeah, straight from Southern California. You're welcome.
Yeah.
Obligatory weather jokes out of the way. We looked out the tower's windows with a 360-degree view of the Seattle housing market, and I asked Humphreys for an overview.
The Seattle housing market went into decline a lot later than the rest of the country. The rest of the country peaked in the second quarter of 2006, whereas the Seattle housing market peaked just about a full year later.
And why was that?
The first factor has to do with Seattle didn't see the big run-up that a lot of the big coastal markets did, like Los Angeles and San Francisco and many parts of Florida. The other factor has to do with just the overall economy of the Northwest does tend to lag the rest of the country in terms of the cycles that it undergoes.
So what is the state of the housing market then? Home prices must have taken a dip.
Yeah, Seattle is actually a very typical market when you think about the rest of the country, that so many of the reports that we hear about will focus on the really hard-hit markets like Vegas and Phoenix, where values are down half of where they were at the peak. Seattle has been much more typical. Home values are down about 24% from peak, and that's exactly where the nation is. And like the rest of the country, in 2009, we've seen some stabilization in those depreciation rates.
So we've been talking about really the metro area, and we're looking here to the west at downtown, the Space Needle. Let's move around the water tower just a bit and look out to the east across Lake Washington. So let's go over to this window here. Tell us a little bit about what the situation is across the lake.
With Lake Washington, we're actually seeing one of the key demarcating boundary line for Seattle housing performance in the region, where areas within the Seattle city, so on this side of the water, have in general held their values better during the housing downturn than outlying areas from Seattle. And outlying areas here, since we're on the Puget Sound, really means areas to the north, east, and south of us, since we can't really go further west without being in the water.
Right.
So as we look across the
water... And how are housing values there?
The housing, they're really underwater out there. So if you were to draw a concentric circles around Seattle proper, with the center of the circle being the Space Needle, as you got further away from there, you've had larger price declines. So that's a larger change in home values from the peak. That actually is a very common pattern right now in the current housing recession. Of most major metropolitan areas have seen some fairly large gradations between an urban, suburban, and rural housing performance.
Well, shall we head back downstairs and take a look at the specific area that we're in, Capitol Hill?
Sure, that'd be great.
Okay, let's go. A short walk away, we stopped in front of a grand white four-story home on a corner lot in Seattle's Capitol Hill neighborhood. Humphreys pulled out his iPhone, tapped on the Zillow app and pinned the value of this house at?
About $2.95 million. And then this one next to it looks to be quite a bit less, about just over $1 million.
This tree-lined oasis, 14th Street, is known as Millionaire's Row.
In general, it's a pretty hefty price point, even by Seattle standards. The typical home here sells for about $330,000. In the area we're walking around right now, which is one of the more historic areas right next to Volunteer Park, homes will fetch typically more than $1 million.
Any foreclosure issue here? Are prices dropping?
In Capitol Hill, we do still have home values dropping quite substantially. Foreclosure rates are less than half of what they are in the rest of the city. And a lot of that has to do with the affluence of the homeowners here.
Yeah, I mean, you just look around and I can't imagine that these folks are having the same issues as other homeowners might.
They haven't had the same issues in that they haven't had to endure foreclosures yet, but we have a lot of people who are negative equity in this area.
Really? And
yes, absolutely. Who would have bought basically back in 2004, 2005, 2006 and have seen their home values decline substantially. Because of the financial resources of the demographic that lives here, they're able to ride it out. But at some point, even this demographic is going to have to sell, and that could start to contribute to lower prices here.
Well, I hate to leave this neighborhood, but let's head to Renton, one of those concentric circles you talked about, and see how things are going there.
Okay.
You have reached your destination.
We arrived in downtown Renton, southeast from Capitol Hill, and headed for the Liberty Cafe on 3rd Street.
Hey, Stan.
Hello.
Through the magic of radio, we've gone 15 miles in about 10 seconds.
It's amazing.
Renton sits on the south shore of Lake Washington. The city is probably best known as the historic home of aerospace giant Boeing, which began its corporate life here in 1941. 737s are among the models still built on the sprawling campus. But Humphreys told us Renton fell victim to the housing crisis earlier than Seattle proper. Today, one home in every 600 or so is in foreclosure, after partaking, like the rest of the country, in the boom.
Renton did see, like the larger Seattle metro, it saw some increase in home values, again, relative to either what you could rent a home for or median household income. It did see some escalation. What Renton really did see, though, was a lot more new home construction. So a lot of those were at lower price points relative to the Seattle metro.
Is it fair to say that Renton is kind of the typical American suburb when it comes to housing issues?
I think that in many ways you could say that for a suburban environment, Renton, in many ways, is typical of what you see in a lot of other areas. As the housing recession took hold, you did see a dramatic drop in home values. So here in Renton, home values are down about 27% from their peak. I think it's typical for a suburban community in the U.S. right now.
We've been talking a lot about the Seattle area and how it is reflective, or not, of the U.S. housing market, but can you give us an overall sense, a prediction of where the market is going and give us kind of any ray of sunshine, even here in a rainy city?
Sure. I'll do my best there, Tess, to give you a little bit of sunshine. In the near term, unfortunately, what sunshine there is out there has to do with us stabilizing a horrific downturn as opposed to seeing a return to the go-go years in the middle part of this decade. So I tend to think that from where we are right now, we're going to see a bottom in home prices nationally sometime before the middle part of this year. So by June, we would see an end to sustained price declines. The closer we get to June, the more the market is testing my commitment to that prediction. After we hit bottom, we're going to see 3, possibly 5 years of very flat housing performance in the U.S., which I think will be counter to many people's expectations.
Well, that wasn't a whole lot of sunshine. I suppose maybe a little sliver, which is appropriate to this generally gray day.
That's
Stan
right.
Humphreys is the chief economist at Zillow.com, which is headquartered right here in Seattle. Thanks so much. It's been fun traveling around the city with you.
Thanks, Tess. It's been fun to have such a pretty day and see so many different parts of the city.
If you're in the market for a home anywhere, you'll be on the lookout for many of the traditional elements. A nice layout, perhaps a landscaped yard, maybe a few high-end fixtures. But here in Seattle, potential homeowners are willing to pay big bucks for something a little unexpected. We asked one of the city's veteran real estate agents to explain.
Marlo Harris, I'm a real estate broker with SeattleDreamHomes.com. Light's important in Seattle real estate because we only have about 58 sunny days a year. The rest of the days are either cloudy, semi-cloudy, or raining. This is a house that made excellent use of light. Come on in. Because we're so far north here, southern exposure is prized in a home. That's a marketing feature that we use. You know, people will also discuss eastern exposure or western. You never say great northern exposure because that means there's no light. I think light adds actual dollar value to homes in the Pacific Northwest because light is at such a premium. $890,000 with these beautiful spaces and open rooms and lots of light. And if it didn't have this light, it would be very difficult to live here, and the value would probably be 10 or 20% lower. Now, as a contrast, we're going to be entering a home that is a little more light challenged. So, as you can see, it's a really lovely, well-kept home, but because of the way the windows are situated, it's very dark and it's almost oppressive. This building is half the price of the one we just came from. The house that we came from, full of light, was $890,000, and this is on the market for about $500,000. If it had better light, you could probably get another $100,000. Call it feng shui, you could call it exposure, but it has to be the right location to get that kind of light that we're looking for up here.
We have pictures of the home Marlo Harris described at marketplace.org. You know, one lesson we've all learned from the housing crisis is that home ownership is not easy, and sometimes renting is the most financially sound choice. No exceptions here on Puget Sound.
There's absolutely no reason why my bathroom should be this big. Like, for the amount that we pay in rent, your bathroom should literally be, like, just this.
That's next on Marketplace Money. It's from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and we're broadcasting this week from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. You know, it used to be you could feel pretty smug about owning a home, American dream and all that. But renters are the ones preening, told ya, these days. KOW's Ann Dornfeld reports.
Gina Landino and her husband have just signed the paperwork for their new apartment. It's in the Aspira, a brand new high-rise in downtown Seattle.
This is the kitchen I was telling you about, really contemporary finishes, and we love it. Tons of space, and this will be our living area and our beautiful balcony. So we are really excited, as you can tell.
Landino says she's amazed by the value they're getting. They're paying just under $1,500 a month, and their first month is free. She says this building has a ton of features their last one didn't have, like a high-tech media room and terraces to walk your dog. Then there's the $1,500 Visa gift card from the landlord, the waived application fee, and no extra charge for one of their dogs.
We got a free 32-inch TV, so that was really exciting. and, you know, some free storage. We got like 7 months of free storage and some free 3 months of free parking. I mean, it was just, the list kept going and going. It was absolutely, it's amazing.
Landino says she's never seen anything like it as a renter. But deals like these are actually standard in Seattle's rental market these days. According to the market research company Axiometrics, Seattle rents fell an average of 14% from 2008 to 2009, the largest drop among cities nationwide. That's due in part to the large number of apartments that went on the market last year, 6,100 in the Seattle area, the most in two decades. At the same time, companies like Microsoft, which had been steadily hiring, started laying people off instead. As home sales slowed, a lot of condo developers decided to open their new buildings as apartments instead.
Big windows, corner unit on top of a building.
Esteban DeCastro has just moved into a studio apartment in a brand new neighborhood, South Lake Union. The neighborhood is a sea of high-rise apartment buildings, all built within the past few years. DeCastro has rented in Seattle since the late 90s, but he says never in a place as nice as this.
There's absolutely no reason why my bathroom should be this big. Like, for the amount that we pay in rent, your bathroom should literally be, like, just this. But it's huge. And, like, the high ceilings totally, like, throws it off, because it makes it seem like I'm living in a cavern, which is nice. I've never done that before. Usually my apartment is, like, so small that I hate it.
DeCastro says based on the way rent prices had been going, he expected to schlep out to the burbs to find something he could afford. Instead, for $1,400, he's walking distance to downtown in a new building with high ceilings, hardwood floors, and a bathroom you could park a car in. DeCastro says there can be a downside to having so many new apartment buildings on the market. His sister is renting in a new development where DeCastro says so many units are vacant that it feels kind of creepy.
The people there, they're bending over backwards to try to get anybody and everybody to stay in their place. It feels like desperation because I'm there every day and I always see the signs, you know, referral. You know, we'll give you $500 to get somebody to come and stay here, which is an awesome deal, but you wouldn't have had to do that before. People would just move into an apartment because they needed a place to stay before.
Desperate times call for desperate measures from landlords. A few miles away on Capitol Hill, visitors to the Chloe Apartments are greeted by a googly-eyed baby King Charles Spaniel.
Oh, hello. Who are you?
Chloe.
Hi, Chloe. Oh, you are precious.
Barry Blanton develops marketing strategies for Lorg Property Management, which oversees the Chloe Apartments. The building opened last fall.
As you're opening a new building and everybody was opening them at kind of the same time, what do you do different? And so everybody was doing kind of the same thing. And we thought, well, what if Chloe's a dog?
A billboard on one side of the building features a huge photo of Chloe with her head cocked toward the busy street. Blanton says a puppy makes a very effective leasing agent.
In 2009-10, the world got kind of cold. It got tough. You know, the economy was tough and everything else. And I think the dog warms it up. It makes it relationship. And people were looking for comfort.
Renters can take comfort in knowing that analysts expect Seattle rent prices to drop another 9% before bottoming out next year. In Seattle, I'm Ann Dornfeld for Marketplace Money.
And we're in Seattle this week examining the housing situation, but that does not mean we've forgotten about the rest of y'all. It's time to take your questions on housing and the rest of your finances. And I'm joined this week by Karen Ramsey. She's a certified financial planner right here in Seattle. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Tess.
Now, we have come to your fair city to explore these housing issues. What are you hearing from your clients about their homes and how their situations are?
Well, they're beginning to breathe again. It was a little scary for a while. I think market prices are stabilizing.
Yeah.
They were on a decline for quite a while, and people were really worried if they were going to want to sell their houses. And I have a couple of acquaintances that are real estate agents, and they're actually, you know, signing deals and making it happen, and that's new in the last 3 or 4 months.
Right, right. Well, our first caller happens to have a question about real estate. Mary is with us from Orlando, Florida. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
What's your current housing situation?
I'm 70 years old. I'm a widow, retired. I used to own a house many years ago, and I found it to be so much work, and so it really tied me down as a single mom.
So are you in an apartment right now?
I'm in a mobile home.
Boy, mobile home in Florida. Hurricane season is almost upon us. How are you feeling about that?
Well, I've been through a couple of hurricanes and survived, so I'm not nervous really about that.
Well, that's good to know.
But I'm in a quandary really. I had my savings in a CDs paying 4.5%.
Wasn't that wonderful while it lasted?
It was. It really
was.
Ancient
history now.
But it recently went under.
Oh, your bank did?
Yes.
So my guess is that now they're saying that this interest rate on your CDs is going to change.
1%.
Oh.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Oh, that's painful.
If everything is going to be stagnant, that's going to leave me in a hole because I have really no pension, only my savings and Social Security. So what I'm mulling over in my mind, the only way to make my savings grow would be to buy a home.
Oh boy. Karen, this sets off all kinds of alarm bells for me. I don't know about you. You know, folks
folks who are thinking that a home is going to be an investment and is going to bring them more money than, say, a savings account. That really worries me.
Yeah, that really worries me, Mary. In my experience as a financial planner, a home is a roof over your head because you can't get the money out of it as long as you're in it. It's not a liquid asset. The only way to get the money back out of it is to sell it, which then you don't have a roof over your head, or to take a line of credit against it, and then you're paying somebody else money as opposed to having the money work for you. So I would strongly encourage you to do something different than either the CD or the home, which is get it into a diversified portfolio of no-load mutual funds.
Mm.
Because, you know, at 70, you sound like you're healthy and you sound like you got a lot of life ahead of you, and you got to make sure that this money keeps working for you.
Yeah, well, it's good to get a point of view from you because a lot of my friends are encouraging me, you know, oh, buy a house.
So you think you're going to stay there in your mobile home?
I think so. I used to be a realtor years ago. So when I first moved to Florida, I couldn't jump into the game. I saw that it was an obvious bubble, and I thought I'll wait until it comes out the other end. But now it has, and I'm still leery about it. So,
well, I think your leeriness is a good thing. You just don't want to be cash house rich and cash poor.
Yeah.
Mary, thanks for the call.
Thank you so much.
Thank Bye-bye. You, Mary.
Well, if you've got a financial question, do give us a call anytime. Our number is 877-275-6669, or you can write to us. Use the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Well, back to the phones. We've got Liz on the line. She's in Montgomery, Alabama. And Liz, I understand you have some questions about opening a yoga studio. But first, tell us a little bit. You're retired now? You used to be a nurse?
Yes, I'm a retired Air Force nurse. But into my nursing career, I got very interested in yoga and have since become a yoga teacher.
Wow. How long were you in the Air Force?
20 years.
Wow. 20 years. Did you travel around the world?
I did. It was a great experience. I would not trade it for anything in the world.
What'd you do?
I started in California, then I went to Oklahoma, then I went to Guam, and then from there I went to Mississippi. And then from Mississippi, I went to Germany. I was stationed at Landstuhl, Germany.
That is one beautiful country.
It was the greatest being in the country, but the assignment was kind of tough because we did see a lot of wounded war vets. They all come through Landstuhl before they come over here to Walter Reed.
And is that how you got into yoga, so that would be kind of a counterbalance to everything else that was happening at work?
What really happened was, because I was in the military, you have to run a mile and a half in a certain time, and you have to do sit-ups, and you have to do this fitness test every year.
Karen, you and I do that all the time, don't we?
Yeah, right. Okay, I'll meet you out front for that mile and a half run after we're done with this test.
So anyway, I would go to the gym every morning before work, and I just was getting tighter and tighter, and there's this little yoga studio. I'd pass it all the time, and I'd think, oh, I should just stop in there. That would be good for flexibility. And so finally I did, and the yoga teacher said many things that I did not believe when she first said them. And one thing she said was that yoga will change your life forever. And, you know, in my mind I sort of rolled my eyes and said, oh, I'm just here for the stretching, you know. But it really did.
But you've become a believer.
It did change my life because if you really practice yoga and you take it off the mat, then you have this ability to improve this little cloud of environment that kind of travels with you.
Mm-hmm. Well, so is this your retirement plan? Are you going to do yoga all day?
Well, that's what I'd like to do. I would love to teach two or three
classes
a day.
Okay.
And right now I volunteer teach. And I have to tell you, I see the changes in people.
Now, I have to ask you, though, how zen are you feeling about your finances?
I worked really hard to position myself so that I could retire at an early age and have enough money that I don't have to work. And, you know, while some people at my rank were living in $250,000 houses, I was living in $150,000. You know, I mean, I always lived below my income as I progressed in rank. And so I saved quite a bit of money. And then my father and mother left me an inheritance. So I have it in the stock market, and I have a financial planner that helps me you know, manage that. And then I have a thrift savings plan. I've got like about $40,000 in that that's just sitting there.
But back to the yoga, you want to open your own studio?
I do. Yeah. So I want to open my own yoga studio. And my real question to you is, am I just completely crazy? What is the financial risk to me? Am I putting that money in the stock market at risk if things really go wrong and I'm unable to make a go of it?
All right. Well, Karen, I think that we are not going to tell Liz that she's crazy.
Well, she's not crazy.
Okay.
But I heard you say something earlier that you're a planner.
I am.
And I think now's the time to pull out those planning skills before you do anything financially. In other words, you want to make sure that you have a business plan. There's lots of resources on the web for good business plan templates. And what you want to do is you want to make sure that you have your expenses of how much it's going to cost,
mm-hmm.
and how many classes you'd have to teach and how much you'd have to charge, so that you can see if it's going to be even physically viable before you open the doors, before you do anything with the money.
Right.
And what about this notion of using retirement funds to start a business?
Well, given that you're not 59 and a half, one of the points that I did want to make is if you took your money out of these retirement accounts, I assume that you couldn't take it out before 59 and a half without a 10% penalty, and it would be considered income, so you'd be paying taxes on it.
Yeah, I would take it out. I mean, I have some stocks that are just stock,
oh, okay.
you know, that are not oh, okay. retirement accounts. It's just in the stock market. So
okay.
And the other thing I thought of was I'm trying to get a VA loan because I know they have small business loans, and so I guess mm-hmm. I need to talk to some people about that.
And I bet they would have resources also to help you write a business plan.
Well, and, you know, it's really nice to talk to y'all because I thought really I was just being a big chicken. Thank you for the advice. I really appreciate your time, and I feel much better about my goals now.
Good. Excellent.
Good All luck. Right. Good luck, Liz.
Bye.
All right. Give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. Do I sound relaxed?
Oh, you're so relaxed.
Yeah. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or use the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Karen Ramsey, it's been so much fun taking on these questions with you. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a blast.
And remember to check with a professional before making any big money decisions. Rosette Royale is seeing a different side of the real estate bust here in Seattle. He's the assistant editor of Real Change, a weekly street paper sold by the homeless and low-wage earners. On a rainy day this past week, he told us more about the folks who never had a house to lose.
What if you don't own a home and probably never will? Where's your dream then? What do you do if you're someone like Isaac Shapiro? Isaac is a friend of mine here in Seattle. He's homeless and has been for more than 10 years. He's camped out in tents tucked in parks, trying to stay warm and dry during our rainy winters. He slept in a truck for a while, too, a 74 Chevy pickup someone gave him. His high point came when he got the rights to park a camper trailer in a church parking lot. He ran an extension cord from church to trailer, providing electricity to cook food and stay toasty. Isaac was psyched. But since last fall, things have gone from, ooh, that's bad, to dang, that's terrible for Isaac. The church only let him stay in the parking lot for 6 months, so he had to vacate. Shortly after that, he wound up parking on the street. Then his truck broke down. He got tickets for not moving his vehicle. The truck and trailer got impounded. 2 weeks ago, both were sold at an auction. And, once again, Isaac had nowhere to live. Of course, these days, we hear a lot about people who lose their homes. It was just last week that a new report said that foreclosures in the United States had jumped by 7%. In King County alone, where Seattle is, 741 homes entered in foreclosure proceedings in March. Now, how many of these homeowners facing foreclosure or renters living in soon-to-be foreclosed properties will become homeless? That's unknown. But listen to this. There was this 2009 survey conducted by the National Coalition for the Homeless and other nonprofits, And they found out of almost 200 national organizations that assist the homeless, 10% of their clients had wound up on the streets due to home foreclosures. And while everyone can agree that the increase in home foreclosures is a newsworthy story, there's this other story, and an important story, that's out there that the mainstream media often miss. It's the plight of the long-term homeless, the ones who've never owned a home or rented an apartment. They're people like my friend Isaac, and they deserve to have their stories told. Just the other day, I ran into Isaac. I asked where he stayed at night. He walked me 2 blocks and pointed to the doorway. "Right here. This is it," he said, the exasperation clear on his face. Isaac doesn't know when I'll have the money to buy a tent, much less another vehicle. As for renting or owning, those are both out of the question for the immediate future. Even so, he still holds on to his own version of the American dream, to no longer be defined by what he lacks, a home, but by what he has, a desire to prosper, to live a better life. Though he wouldn't mind an affordable apartment either.
Commentator Rosette Royale of Seattle's street paper Real Change. You can see pictures of the streets where Isaac lives at marketplace.org. Coming up, buying a home in the 21st century.
We'll say right up front, if you don't know how to use the internet, don't have an email address, don't know how to fax, we should not be working together.
That's next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and we're coming to you this week from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. If you're looking for a bargain on your next home, in cities like this one, you might be tempted by a condo. For one thing, they mostly are not foreclosures where someone was evicted. These are brand new units with all kinds of modern features. And there are more of them on the market than single-family houses. We wondered whether a glut like that is a good thing for buyers. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler begins his report at Seattle's most famous landmark.
I'm here at the Space Needle, about 500 feet off the ground, where it's easy to see why Seattle is nicknamed the Emerald City. There is lush greenery between the buildings and the Cascade Mountains rising in the background. From here, you can also see lots of shiny new high-rise condo buildings in the downtown area. What you can't tell, though, is that many of them are half empty. I got a tour of the condo carnage from Paul Thomas. He's in the business of auctioning off real estate and tracks the market closely. But as this next building demonstrates, there isn't much of a market to follow.
Escala here in front of us, it's 230 units, and they've only sold 2 in the last year and a half.
A few blocks away, the next condo tower isn't doing much better.
Right now, the building has almost 100 vacant units out of 143.
There was a lot more demand when the project started, but that was before the market collapsed and investors began to reevaluate.
As of a year ago, about a quarter of the people who had put money down walked away, leaving deposits of up to $100,000 because they saw the values dropping so fast that it was cheaper for them to just walk away and leave their deposit.
The overbuilding is visible in surrounding cities as well, like Bellevue, where the new Bellevue Towers added 550 condos to the market. Michael Brandt moved in last November.
We have a 2-bedroom, 1,500 square foot unit. This is the master bedroom.
It's airy and modern and cheaper than it had been.
Initially, my unit was priced at $566, and it was then reduced by 20%.
The main reason he can get a discount is because the building is 82% empty. So does it feel like a ghost tower?
Having more neighbors wouldn't be a bad thing, but it doesn't feel like a ghost town.
Brandt says solitude has its advantages. For example, he doesn't have to share the building's fancy amenities.
This is the best room in the whole building. We have a spa, we have a sauna, we have a steam room, and we have a hot tub.
No kids in the jacuzzi and no lines for the cardio machines at the gym. But these perks don't come free. They're generally paid for with homeowners' dues. But in this case, the building's owner covers those costs until 60% of the tower's condos are sold.
I'm actually not paying homeowners dues right now and won't be for potentially a year and a half or 2 years down the road.
He's saving $600 to $700 a month in homeowners dues. On the other hand, low occupancy also has some drawbacks. For one thing, owners don't get a representative on the board until the building hits certain occupancy thresholds. And if you tried to sell right away, you'd be competing with the other 400 units for sale in the building.
I don't see myself in that position because I'm planning to stay here for at least 5 years.
Did Brandt get a good deal? The jury is still out. Some expect prices to go lower. Bargain hunters turned out for a condo auction in downtown Seattle last month.
You are going to tell the sellers what these properties are worth. You folks are the marketplace.
When a condo sells here, it helps set the bar for similar properties on the market.
$331,000, final opportunity $331. Anyone else at $331,000? Oh boy, that's close. Now $332.
Sometimes auctions lower the bar. Hoyt Scott bid on a condo that had been listed at $700,000. He bought it at auction for $300,000 less.
So I jumped in and got the unit for actually significantly less than I was prepared to pay for it. So I'm very happy.
Any advice for buyers coming to auctions?
Somebody told me to wait until the bidding gets very close to the end and then jump in for what you really want. And so that's what I tried, and it seemed to work.
That held true at this auction. The price per square foot fell for the last properties to be sold. But consumers have to do their research ahead of time, read the legal documents posted on the auctioneer's website, and buyers have to remember that condos sold at auction are as is. Architect John Eagleston bought a condo at auction last June. He found that amenities promised by the seller don't exist, and no one will take responsibility for fixing problems.
Once the auction was over, everyone just kind of dropped everything and ran. And we've been working for 9 months with the county trying to get our legal description and title correct for tax purposes.
So Eagleston's paying tax on three parking spaces when he only owns one. And there are construction issues, light fixtures that don't work.
Little things like that. They're humorous. I think if I paid full price, I'd be pretty upset about them.
Obviously, a bargain is in the eye of the beholder. Matt Goyer writes a Seattle condo blog. He says some speculators are still snapping up deals.
They've seen these auctions as an opportunity to sort of dollar cost average down by buying a second or third condo.
Goyer isn't interested himself. He already owns two condos, which he bought at the top of the market.
I'm continuing to rent it out and losing money on it every month, and later today I probably go fix a leaky toilet, and I'm just tired of it.
For Goyer, the best bargain would be a chance to get out of this market without losing his shirt. Sometimes saving money looks less attractive than avoiding headaches. In Seattle, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace Money.
So here's how the home buying process has worked, you know, since dinosaurs roamed the earth. Throw the family in the car, schlep around to a few open houses. Getting serious? Get a realtor. But these days, there is another option. Go online. Companies like Zillow, Trulia, and Redfin have transformed the real estate business over the last decade. So, while we're here in Seattle, we decided to drop in on Redfin's headquarters for a chat with Scott Nagel. He's their vice president of real estate operations. We talked in a conference room overlooking the city's waterfront. And I asked Nagel for a little Redfin history.
Redfin started back in September of 2004 when three guys got together and they were looking at real estate and noticed that you can find homes, but you can't really tell where they're at on the internet right at that point. And they had the idea that, wow, it'd make a lot of sense to put homes on a map and be able to search for them that way. Redfin, in its current state, really started in February 2006, where they had the website and decided, hey, we should pair that with a brokerage that's a little bit new and different than anything else that's out there.
You know, when you think of going online and buying stuff, sure, books, clothes, even cars certainly make sense. But boy, when you think about buying a $200,000 home, $500,000 home, beyond that, it's hard to conceive that that would be a good idea.
Well, you know, if it truly was just an online experience, I'd agree with you. But I think the key difference, we have the online component where people can find a home and see the pictures. But we pair that with an expert agent that comes into play right when you need it. They put their expertise and their negotiating experience to work as soon as you've decided on what home you want to buy or anytime earlier when you have questions. So it's not that we won't work with you and help you guide your search, but that a lot of our clients are fully capable of doing that on their own, but realize, okay, we found the one, now help me get it.
Now, this was not something that made the real estate industry terribly happy. You know, they live on commissions, mm-hmm. and they live on showing people homes,
right.
and knowing neighborhoods and knowing markets. Mm-hmm. Talk to us a little bit about that reaction and how you responded to it.
There was definitely, I think, some concern, some fear on the part of the traditional real estate market. One of the things I hadn't mentioned before, when we represent a buyer and the deal closes, we'll take half of the commission that we receive and we'll give that back to the buyer. So on a $500,000 home, 3% commission, we'd get $15,000. About 10 days after the close, we'll send the buyer a check for $7,500. That had traditional agents very concerned.
But then, you know, part of the real estate process, and having worked with, you know, an agent myself, mm-hmm. is that I may not know really what I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm coming to your site and I'm dropping in 5 or 6 homes into my cart,
right.
you know, but part of the role of the agent is to say, well, this one isn't quite what you're looking for, but I have this one over here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, honestly, sometimes the agent will be almost a counselor,
mm-hmm.
you know, as you go through the process.
Right.
And I think that's something that, you know, the real estate industry would say could be missing
mm-hmm.
through merely using technology for something as important as, well, the biggest purchase probably of your life.
You know, there are some people that are not a good fit for us. If you're not comfortable with technology, we'll say right up front, if you don't know how to use the internet, don't have an email address, don't know how to fax, we should not be working together.
Right.
But we do think that we're the best agent for a large percentage of the people out there that have a decent idea of where they want to live and what they're looking for. They can put their tour together, send it in, we'll pick it up first thing in the morning and work from there.
Now, how many markets are you in at this point?
Right now, we're in 12 markets.
So you're up and down the West Coast, I know.
We're up and down the West Coast. We're in Chicago, Boston, Long Island, Washington, D.C., Atlanta, Phoenix.
Major metro areas.
Exactly. Our goal right now is to get into the top 25 major metropolitan areas in the country. Our model doesn't work as well in some place, you know, in the Midwest, Nebraska, South Dakota, where the home prices are low. And the rebate doesn't work quite as well in those type situations.
Now, why not? If I mean, a percentage is a percentage, isn't it?
It is a percentage, but if you have a $100,000 home, a 3% commission is $3,000. You know, splitting that, $1,500 isn't enough. It doesn't work for us, and it doesn't work for the client.
What is it with new avenues of real estate and in Seattle? I mean, this is the home of Zillow.
Yep.
It's the home of you. It's just interesting because Seattle's not necessarily a hotbed of real estate anything.
No, you know, it is interesting. I think it's more just the environment and the technology and the entrepreneurial nature of Seattle more than anything to do with real estate. And so I think there's just a lot of creative people here. And when they're done with one thing, everyone sits down and goes, okay, what are we doing next?
What else are we going to fix?
And, you know, and it's usually, I think, something to where they're probably in the process of looking for a home and went, well, wait a minute, this isn't right. This is broken. We can make this better.
Scott Nagel is the Vice President of Real Estate Operations here at Redfin in Seattle, where we're looking out on beautiful Puget Sound. Thanks so much for chatting with us.
I'd love to show you around. Do you have a few minutes?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, great. So we're heading down now to where the engineers are. They're the ones, like I mentioned, that put the website together, that are constantly working on new releases, new features, more data on the website.
And by the way, I should mention that this looks like a very late 90s.com office.
You know, to some extent,
it looks very fun.
Yeah, it is.
Bright colors.
Yes. This used to be the offices of the Cranium Company, the ones that put out the fun board game.
Oh, right.
That has a lot of different colors. So you'll see a lot of purple, a lot of blue, a lot of yellow. And the new Power Generation Lounge is interesting. It's a Prince motif, purple furniture, the Prince symbol, and all for reasons that no one's sure of.
Love sacks.
So giant bean bags called love sacks spread around. We'll just have people flop on them and talk. Or when kids visit the office, they're a huge success.
What are we setting up for here?
So now, every Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday, we bring lunch in for everybody.
Oh, nice.
And so,
it looks and smells like lunch is here.
It brings everybody together. And you get that cross-pollination of real estate going, man, I wish we had this.
And engineers and agents living
going, huh,
together.
In peace and harmony. It's
cats
just fantastic. It's a beautiful story.
Thanks for the tour, Scott.
Hey, you're welcome. It's a pleasure. Yeah, and thanks again for coming to see us.
Marketplace Money is supported by Nixon Peabody LLP, a full-service international law firm whose size, diversity, and technological resources enable it to offer practical solutions for today's real-world business challenges. More at nixonpeabody.com. By Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
And finally, no trip to Seattle would be complete without a visit to the city's famed Pike Place Market. The flying fish, the ubiquitous buskers, try saying that 5 times fast, and of course, the guy charging a buck for you to take a picture with his six-toed cat. But among these Seattle cliches, one more stands out, and it also just happens to be a personal finance cliche. We had so much fun with Seattle certified financial planner Karen Ramsey earlier in the show that we asked her to meet us at Pike Place for a discussion of this received wisdom. So Karen, here we are outside the very first Starbucks.
Welcome.
Thank you, but I don't see a cup of coffee in your hands.
Well, no, you don't see a cup of coffee in my hand because I don't drink coffee, but I'm probably one of the only two people in the city who don't.
Okay, well, the reason we're here is because it does seem like Starbucks has become a part of personal finance lore.
Right.
Ask anyone, you know, how you can cut your budget. Oh, it's the $4 cup of coffee that's got to go.
Right.
What do you think about that?
Well, I say, let's take a different tact. What if you really looked at what you spent your money on in all categories, and then you decided what was really important to you? And if coffee drinking is really important, then that's not where you should cut. Maybe it's eating out. How about that telephone charge that you have every month, that you now have a $200, you must have cell phone bill every month?
And it doesn't taste very good.
And it doesn't taste very good.
And it doesn't keep me awake.
No, it doesn't. The thing to think about in the spending of money is how much does it really cost you to do what you're doing, and are you consciously doing that, or is it unconscious? So if people get a couple of Starbucks coffees a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, do you know how much money that is?
Do people really drink that much?
Oh, we're in Seattle, yes. That's $2,912 a year.
Ouch.
So I can go to Hawaii for that much money.
Why do you think the Starbucks cup of coffee has become so symbolic of frivolous spending?
Well, I think it's something that people do unconsciously.
Hmm.
You know, we didn't used to have to go to anywhere to get our cup of coffee. It was brewed at home. And then, you know, it started out at like a couple bucks, and now it's escalated. So it's gotten to be a big ticket item as opposed to where it started, which is everybody felt like they could do it.
So your real message here is that you got to decide what's important to you. And if it is that $4 cup of coffee, or at least the $4 latte,
so
go for it.
That's right. Yeah, it's all about your personal goals and values and what's important.
Well, I have not had my grande, extra hot, non-fat, dirty chai yet today, so I believe that's going to be about $4.25 for me, but I'm going to do it anyway.
If that's what makes you happy, you go for it.
Thanks, Karen.
Okay, thanks.
And to test this budgeting wisdom, we asked a few Seattleites wandering around Pike Place if they would ever cut out the daily coffee run.
I would never cut back on coffee, ever.
I don't drink coffee, so...
Probably not. Being a true Seattleite, I drink coffee every day, and I'm something that I probably wouldn't be able to make from home.
I'm pretty much addicted to the beans, so I would cut back somewhere else before I cut back my coffee consumption.
And by the way, this week Starbucks announced first quarter profits of $217 million. That's a lot of lattes. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, very rich people have a lot of things the rest of us don't. And maybe we don't want them.
Is having an entirely separate house to do the wash something to aspire to? Isn't that kind of like having to go to a laundromat?
Aw, boo-hoo. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Trobe. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Many thanks this week to our hosts and friends here at KUOW in Seattle, including engineer Doug Patterson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We're back in L.A. next week, a little less caffeinated,
a little more warm. There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering new ways for investors to pursue their goals with lower volatility on the web at putnam.com/absolute return.
American Public Media.